Go ahead and open your Bibles to 1 Timothy chapter 3. 1 Timothy chapter 3. There is a wonderful book entitled The Master Plan of Evangelism, written by Robert Coleman back in the early 60s. And in it, he examines from the life of Jesus, the different elements of discipleship, the things Jesus did with his own disciples. He starts with selection, and then he talks about association and consecration. He talks about how Jesus used demonstration as far as ministry training, delegation, supervision, and reproduction. And as he goes through those eight different elements of discipleship, he says the most important element of all those eight is the first one. Selection. Selection, because if you don't select well, then the other seven won't go well at all. Think as well, even a better example, of Jesus himself. You know that before he spent 3 years with the disciples ministering to the people of Israel, training those disciples on how to do ministry themselves. And the fact that he was the Son of God, so he could have fixed anything that went wrong. He could have done anything that needed to be done to help these guys get what they needed to understand. Before he selected the 12 men that he would give his life to, what did he do? He went up on the mountain and prayed. Not just for an hour, not just for 2 hours, not just for 3 hours. He prayed the entire night. And when he was finished, he came down and he selected the disciples. Selection is vital when you talk about ministry. And it is vital for the church today that good selection would be done for those who would serve as leaders in the church. Next week, we're going to look at deacons. Last few weeks, we have looked at elders and their qualifications. Today, we have moved from the necessity of qualifications for elders, looking at their desire and their direction. We've looked at the first 12 of 15 qualifications as Paul lays them out here, seeing that there is an overarching qualification that Paul terms as above reproach, and then he starts to fill that out, talking about how the elder has to have a character of prudence and temperance, be hospitable and able to teach, not addicted to wine, not pugnacious, but be somebody who can be patient and peaceable, not bound by a love for money. This morning, Lord willing, we'll look at verses 4 through 7 here in 1 Timothy 3 and look at the last three qualifications of the biblical elder. To get a running start, again, we'll start in verse 1 and read the entire passage and then put our focus on those last four verses. Paul writes, "It is a trustworthy statement. If any man aspires to the office of overseer, it is a fine work he desires to do. An overseer then must be above reproach, the husband of one wife, temperate, prudent, respectable, hospitable, able to teach, not addicted to wine or pugnacious, but gentle, peaceable, free from the love of money. He must be one who manages his own household well, keeping his children under control with all dignity. But if a man does not know how to manage his own household, how will he take care of the church of God? And not a new convert, so that he will not become conceited and fall into the condemnation incurred by the devil. And he must have a good reputation with those outside the church, so that he will not fall into reproach and the snare of the devil." These last three conditions you can see transition from just looking at the character qualities of an individual and begin to take into account confirmation by those outside the person. In the three qualifications given here, you first have a description of the qualification and then the reason that qualification is important when you're thinking about leadership in the church. You see in verses 4 and 5 the qualification that is given in relation to the man's family. In verse 6, you see the qualification given in relation to his maturity. And then finally in verse 7, the qualification given in relation to his community. Let's look first at the one in relation to his family, beginning with verse 4. Paul says he must be one who manages his own household well. The word manages there can be understood to direct, to rule, to care for, in general, just to lead or to superintend. When you think about a family, there are issues that need to be taken care of, and the father of the family is called on to lead the family, his wife and his children, through that and do it well. The sense of the word manage is seen over in Romans 12:8. It talks about leading there with diligence, working at it. It's not something that's just going to happen. You have to give attention to it. Over in 1 Thessalonians 5:12, it talks about appreciating those who diligently labor among you as they exercise oversight and care for you. Here, the man is said to be one who needs to manage his own household well. You're familiar with the word household, oikos. This is the word used here. This would be the social unit that is together, usually consisting of a family that we know of as a family, but also likely to include servants, people that help around the house, and even extended family. And so whatever the man's household would be, family, extended family, servants, whatever that looks like, he is called to rule over that, to take care of that, to manage that well. Look again at verse 4. There's more specific detail given to what Paul is saying. He says, keeping his children under control with all dignity. Keeping his children under control, keeping them in subjection, keeping them obedient. The verb was a military term of the day, and it meant to have the soldiers under an officer's care fall in line as they're organized according to battalions or certain groupings. You bring that thought into the home life, and what Paul's saying is that the home life needs to be such that the children are orderly, that there is a orderliness to what's going on in the home. Now, this doesn't mean the children are perfect. Otherwise, there'd be nobody who measured up to qualifications here. But children are disciplined and directed and moved, trained, discipled in such a way that they can be characterized as being under control. The last part of verse 4 adds more detail with these words, with all dignity. With all dignity. The word there can be understood as reverence or propriety or holiness. The old King James Version says, with all gravity, talking about the weight of what's being spoken here. These words can be taken to describe one of two things. First, they can be understood to describe the children's actions, that they are under control with dignity. They're acting with dignity. The result of the father's management causes them to have a dignified or reverent life. I think it's better, though, to take the words with all dignity as describing the manner in which the father is controlling the children, keeping with all dignity his children under control. The focus here is on the parent. It's not on the children. The focus is for the father to accomplish this exercise of control in such a way that it's still honorable, it's still respectable, it's still dignified in how he deals with his children. You understand that you can control people or situations with an iron hand, and you can make things happen that aren't dignified, that aren't respectable, but you can still make the control happen. So as Paul describes the manner in which this is done, as he's talking about people that will shepherd the congregation, it makes sense that he would say, no, this needs to be done with dignity. The goal is not just some kind of rigid control that nothing ever gets out of line. The goal is the shepherding. The father who is managing his household well sees himself as a fellow sinner and trying to encourage his children to follow the Lord and to live in a way that honors him. Think about a garden. If you drive by and see a garden that is completely out of control, who do you blame? Do you blame the garden? Like, that garden needs to get its act together. It needs to start making some fruitfulness and take care of itself a little bit better. No, when you see a garden out of control, you look to the gardener. The gardener needs to do some work here. The gardener needs to exercise some wisdom on helping this to become productive. He needs to deal with the weeds, to pull them, to cultivate, to nurture, to make the soil such that it can help the plant produce. He needs to provide the water, make sure the proper amount of sunlight is getting onto the plants. The goal is not to bring a flamethrower into the garden to destroy all the weeds and make sure there are no weeds in the garden. The goal is not to have some orderly lines of dirt where it looks neat, but there are no plants because you've destroyed everything in there by taking care of the weeds. You see, there's balance there, isn't there? There's understanding that you can have out of control garden, or you can have dirt, and that's it. And you can say, look at this dirt, it's so neat, there's not a weed in this dirt. And everybody would say, how beautiful that dirt is. But God is saying, no, there is the goal here, just like the gardener has for his garden, of the children in the home, not to be out of control, but not to have zero life. They're locked up, so there's no out of control opportunities for them. No, they're living, they're functioning, they're growing, they're stumbling, they're wandering, they're trying their best to follow after the Lord, and father and mother working alongside are helping these children to grow, to be fruitful. He must be one who manages his own household well, keeping his children under control with all dignity. Turn over to Titus 1:6. We've done this often because in this book, Paul also writes to a pastor of a different place, but he gives him qualifications for eldership here as well. Titus chapter 1, looking at verse 6. There's a different nuance here regarding children of an elder's home. If any man is above reproach, the husband of one wife, having children who believe, not accused of dissipation or rebellion. This seems to deepen it, doesn't it? Talking more about not just outward behavior, but children who believe. There's a challenge here. There's a challenge because the phrase children who believe can also be understood as children having faithfulness or children who are faithful. The translators of the New American Standard have taken the understanding of this to have, they have actual faith. Children have the faith and they're following after their parents. And that's a wonderful thing. And that would be a great qualification to have, that the children have lived a life under the direction and supervision of the father and the mother, and they're come to a point where they make a decision for the faith themselves and they begin to follow after Christ themselves. There is the understanding as well, though, especially when you look at the last part of verse 6, not accused of dissipation or rebellion, where it seems to point to these children not just having faith, not just having made an expression of faith, but they have come to the point where they are living a life that is faithful to father and mother and to the Christian faith. The goal would not to be just have to have outward obedience. That misses the heart of what all the gospel is about, all of scripture is about. But it's not also just to have an expression of faith, and as long as you have made a profession of faith, it doesn't matter how you're acting, because you're a Christian. And again, we can err in both ways, emphasizing too much just outwardness or too much just make a decision and everything will be okay. There is a life pattern of orderliness in this family, and as you think about the children in the family, you understand that God is working in this family in such a way that you could actually call a man who's coming into the position of being an elder, you could call it a family calling. There are qualifications that have just to do with him, but they also involve his home. And so the whole family is called. God is working in all the family. We should expect that an elder's children would come to faith. we should expect that they would follow after Christ just like the Father is. I don't want to go too far in that, however, to make it a categorical statement because of just one word, just one name. That would be Judas. When you think about Judas, do you look at Christ and say, if his discipleship was better, Judas could have made it? Do you look at Christ and say, you know what, there was something missing in how he worked with the 12. He got through to the 11, but that one he just didn't work well with. And you would say, no, because the Bible tells us that Judas was appointed for this purpose, and God had Jesus choose him because he was going to be the one who betrayed him later on. Well, God has plans for all people, all children, and all families. And just because we have the end of Judas's life explained to us in the Gospels before it happened, doesn't mean God only works in that situation and not in everybody else's situation. So we want to be careful that we don't think like behaviorists that if a child wanders, it has to be the parent's fault. Because if you do this and this and this, then for sure this is going to happen. There were people in Israel who thought that. In fact, there was a proverb that one generation eats sour grapes, so the next generation's teeth are set on edge. And God said, that proverb should not even be talked about in Israel, because that's not the way I work. He said this over in Ezekiel 18 and verse 20. Every father is responsible for his own sin. Every son is responsible for his own sin. He's not going to hold father accountable for son's sin or son accountable for father's sin. Now, of course, there are lackings in any kind of parenting of any kind of child. But ultimately, each one stands before God on his or her own. And so we want to be very careful about making a broad brush statement that unless every single child of the elder, even when they come to adulthood, is walking with Christ, then they're automatically disqualified. But we also want to be careful on the other side and say, well, it doesn't really matter because they're adult children and, you know, he's not responsible for them. It's something that you have to walk through very carefully, case by case, and look at the situation. Again, as we've said several times in our look at this passage, none of these qualifications stand alone. They all move together. You're not going to find a man who meets 14 of the qualifications and one is just way out in left field. They move together. And so the above reproach umbrella statement at the beginning of this passage will take care of likely many of the issues that would be drawing concern to those who are looking at a potential elder regarding his family. Now, why has God given this as a qualification? Back to 1 Timothy 3. The statement is made, the description is there of the qualification in verse 4. We have a parenthesis in verse 5. Paul says there, giving the reason, but if a man does not know how to manage his own household, how will he take care of the church of God? If he doesn't know, if he doesn't have the ability to manage his own household, how will he take care of the church of God? Taking care of there, the word can also mean to think about, to care for. There's emotion involved there. There's a sensitivity in working with the people under his care there. And the church of God is that called out body of believers that assemble together. And what we are seeing here is that the family is a microcosm of the church. And that what's going on in a man's family will necessarily lead over into what's going on in the church where he is a leader. Right? And so this has to be a qualification because of the similarity between a family and a church. You can go over to Ephesians 2:19, in fact, and see where God's church is called God's household. He calls it his household. And so if you're going to exercise oversight in this household, it would make sense. Well, we should look at his own household and see how things are going there. And then we can move forward and call him or not call him to a position of leading the church. As you think about family, as you think about ministry, you see here that family has to come first. It's the priority. The children that God gives you are your disciples. They are the immediate ones that you are to work with. God says, here is a soul, I want you to raise it for me. God has not called men to neglect their family so that they can focus on church work and do things with the church because it's more important or more public and that the family will just be taken care of. He has called you to work with your children first, and then as they are not perfect, as they are being discipled, and it's evident to everybody that you're serious about the souls of your children, then you have opportunity to serve in the church in the same way, because it's the same ministry. It's the same thing. It's shepherding. Think about working with children. A given child is going to move through a variety of circumstances in life. Some are going to be easy to deal with, like, should I sin or should I not sin? Some are going to be very difficult. We're going to have to get down and really think about what the situation that the child's going through is. And how can I help him? How can I help her move through this in a way that grows his or her faith? That he would understand. She would understand that God is wanting him or her to follow him. There's also going to be a variety of children. You know, if you have more than one child, that children are different. And you look at them, you say, how in the world are these two children so different? They came from the same mother and the same father, and they have completely different strengths and weaknesses. And so as a parent, you have the opportunity to say, not only do I know how to work with this particular child through this variety of circumstances, but these two different children through these varieties of circumstances. And then as God blesses and perhaps adds more children, you have many different circumstances and many different varieties of personality and strengths and weaknesses, and God has given you all of this, and you spend time on your knees because you need wisdom to think through, how do I work through these situations? It calls for selflessness as well. Listen, these are the exact same things you will experience as an elder in a church. A variety of people, a variety of circumstances, walking through difficult issues, thinking through, how do I deal with this situation from a biblical perspective as you interact with a group of men serving in a plurality of elders and trying to lead the church in the power of the Holy Spirit based on His Word. Now, if you don't have children or you don't have a wife, that does not disqualify you from ministry. The qualification here is not that you have a wife and that you have some children. It's how you are managing your home, dealing with your children. If you don't have a wife or a child, the qualifications that are being talked about here, the ability to shepherd effectively, they just have to be looked at from a different perspective. They have to be researched a little bit more deeply. Qualification here can be found by looking at evidence that's more difficult to find. You know, sometimes a lawyer receives a case, and it's easy. It's cut and dry. It's the law's here, and this is what's going to happen, and let's just move forward. Other times, there's not as much evidence, and there needs to be some real detailed work done so that he can move forward, she can move forward with an understanding of how to best have the law applied. Now listen, God takes this seriously, this parenting of children. You remember what he said to Eli back in 1 Samuel 3? Turn there. We won't read the whole account, but just look at 1 Samuel 3 and verse 13. You remember Eli's sons, not good men. They were not moral men in their relationships with women. They would come into the whole process of the people offering sacrifice, and they would take the meat by force and not follow the rules that God had laid out. The people would remind them that this is not the way God wants you to do that, and they would silence them and say, if you don't give it to us now, we'll take it by force. These were just ungodly sons. They needed to have some direction. They were out of control. And they were adult sons as well. 1 Samuel 3 and verse 13. Let me get there. In that day, this is God speaking about Eli, I will carry out against Eli all that I have spoken concerning his house from beginning to end. For I have told him that I am about to judge his house forever for the iniquity which he knew, because his sons brought a curse on themselves. Here's the point. And he did not rebuke them. He didn't do anything about it. This was his responsibility, not only as a priest, but as a father. Take care of the situation. We don't have to go to the Old Testament to find examples of men who have served, in one sense, in the church, but neglected their own children. There's an old evangelist who ministered back in the early 1900s. His name was Billy Sunday. He was a baseball player for what was then known as the Chicago White Stockings. God saved him in the late 1800s, and he was a gifted communicator. Now, his style of communication would be uncomfortable for most of us. It was full of histrionics, very out loud, very uncomfortable. We'll just put it that way. But he was gifted at communicating. He could draw large audiences. And this was a time in our nation where people went to revivals, and that was something that was popular to go to. And so he would preach in these things. All along that as he's teaching and preaching and evangelizing in these kind of events, though, his children are just wandering off. So much so, three of his sons, they all died before the age of 40, and they didn't die of natural causes. It was all because of profligate living. And they ruined so much of what he had done in trying to evangelize. He was able to look back on his life and understand that he had been used by God to save many, many souls. And yet he had lost his children. This is not something that God is talking about here in 1 Timothy 3 regarding qualification for an elder. He's saying that doesn't go together for somebody who's to lead the church. So first, this morning, in relation to his family, we see the qualification. Look now in relation to his maturity. Verse 6. The sentence continues after the parenthesis in verse 5. And not a new convert. Not a new convert. The Greek word there is neophytos. You can hear the word in English, neophyte, right? Not somebody who's newly converted. The word is a compound. The word new, along with the word plant. Understand this as a plant that's just recently sown. The same metaphor is used for Christians back in 1 Corinthians 3, where it talks about a person being planted, another person watering him, and God causing the growth in that person. A plant needs to be hardened before it is able to stand on its own. Even if this plant is going to turn into a giant oak and be strong and unaffected by the weather, at the beginning, it is very tender and it is in much danger from all inclement weather, animals, anything. It can't stand on its own. It needs to be taken care of. And Paul's saying the same thing here. Not a new convert, not somebody who's so new that they can't stand on their own, that they haven't proven themselves yet. This is difficult for us because we're not talking about little plants as we talk about leadership in the church. We're not talking about children. That would be easy if there was just an age requirement, like President of the United States or something like that, but it's not there. Remember Israel's first king, Saul. He looked the part. He was taller than everybody else, handsome, strong, rugged. Everybody wanted to follow that guy. But his heart wasn't there. He wasn't ready. He didn't last. And that's what will happen here if a person's a brand new convert. There's so much danger there. Hebrews 5 tells us in verse 14 that wisdom and maturity come from the opportunity that you have to practice. Practice and train your senses so that you can discern good and evil. When you first come to Christ, yes, the Holy Spirit is indwelling you. You think you know it all. You remember those days, right, when you think you knew it all? You think, oh, I just need a couple months. I'll read the Bible. I'll get all that down, and I can move on with the rest of my Christian life. And then you start realizing months and years and decades into it that, wow, this takes a long time. In fact, this is a lifelong pursuit of getting to know God and understand how to live for Him. You don't know that when you're first starting out. There's danger there. Look at the reason for the qualification, the second half of verse 6. Not a new convert. So that, this is clear for us. We don't have to guess, like, why is Paul saying this? He says, I'm going to say this, and I'm going to tell you why I'm saying this. So that he will not become conceited and fall into the condemnation incurred by the devil. He won't become conceited. The Greek word there for becoming conceited is tuphao. It's to be blinded or puffed up, arrogant, even wrapped in smoke or mist. So here's a person who is coming to a situation, and the danger is that if it's not dealt with well, he will end up walking in the blindness of pride, living in a smokescreen of pride. He can't see himself correctly. He can't see others correctly. What's the danger here? Why would he become conceited? When you're put into leadership, this is always a danger, no matter what you're being put into the leadership of. But in the church, this is true. There are certain denominations where those who are the leaders of the church sit in chairs that are so elaborate, so ornate, that you would fairly call them thrones up in the front of the church. And as they sit in those thrones, that's got to affect the mind, because you look at everybody else sitting out in the pew and you're sitting in the throne. Look at me. I've arrived and I'm a young man. I just came to Christ, but I've got some powerful communication skills. God must really need me. And that just begins to build. And you walk about with a skewed perspective of yourself. You're in a smokescreen. I remember a church that I served at in the past. And they had the pastors not sit on thrones, thank the Lord, but sit in chairs on the platform and look out at everybody else during the time of the worship. I hated that. I hated that. I couldn't wait to have that change. And over the years, it did eventually change, thankfully. But to have people sitting up there looking down at the rest of the people, that just does something to the mind. It separates congregation from leader. And whether you have thrones or no thrones, whether you have platform or no platform, just the title, just the idea that you're a leader in the church, you're an elder in the church, that does something to a mind. And if the mind is not trained and developed and humbled through the process of refinement that God brings you through, there is a likelihood of conceit. There's a likelihood of pride overtaking and causing you to be unfruitful. The fruit of over-rapid advancement is blindness, Paul's saying. The end of verse 6, he goes on and says more, and fall into the condemnation incurred by the devil. More precisely, fall into the judgment of the devil. And the phrase judgment of the devil can be taken two ways. And this is the same as at the end of verse 7, so we'll revisit this. Judgment of the devil could be the judgment which the devil does, or it could be the judgment which he receives. The translators here have taken this to be understood as the judgment which he receives, incurred by the devil. And that makes sense because of the devil's history. Back in Isaiah chapter 14, we see the pride connected to his fall, as God communicates through Isaiah regarding the devil, as the taunt is given to the king of Babylon, whose ultimate power source was Satan himself. over in verses 13 and 14. Well, I'll start with verse 12. How you have fallen from heaven, O star of the morning, son of the dawn. You have been cut down to the earth, you who have weakened the nations, but you said in your heart, I will ascend to heaven. I will raise my throne above the stars of God, and I will sit on the mount of assembly in the recesses of the north. I will ascend above the heights of the clouds. I will make myself like the Most High. The devil received condemnation because of pride, and a new convert can fall into the same temptation and receive the same judgment if he runs with his pride. So there's a spiritual maturity that must be had by the elder moving into his position as shepherd. In relation to his family first, in relation to his maturity, finally, verse 7, in relation to his community. We've made it, the 15th and final qualification. And he must have a good reputation with those outside the church. A good reputation. The word reputation there in the Greek is martyros. Martyria, excuse me, martyria. Not that you care. Martyria. But you can hear martyr in there, can't you? It means testimony. It's the word from which we get martyrdom. How did we get from martyria and martyr to testimony? The Puritans talked about dying well. They talked about living well as well. But they talked about a true follower of Christ would die well. Because this would be the consummation of his or her testimony. And the idea of moving through death in the same faithfulness that you moved through life. That was a focus, and that should be something that we think about as Christians. Not in a morbid sense, but the idea that there will come a time when you die, and it might be a long process, and you want to do it well. And so plan for it. Think about it. Get your mind set on heaven. So as you're ready to move through that, it's not something that shocks you or scares you, because God will be with you through that, just like he has been with you throughout all of your life. The testimony, then, of each individual can be good or bad. Paul is saying here, don't choose somebody to be a leader in the church who has a bad testimony. Not that they can't stand up in front of people and give their gospel testimony in 3 minutes and describe how their life was before Christ and how they were saved and what life has been like after Christ, but their life testimony. In Acts chapter 6, in verse 3, this word is used to describe those who would become the first deacons. Those that had a good reputation, they would be the ones that are called upon to help serve the tables in such a way that would benefit the church there. Over in Titus 1, in verse 13, this same word is used in a negative way to talk about the Cretans' testimony. The people in the Isle of Crete described as liars, gluttons, evil. Paul says the testimony is true. That's what they're like. That's their testimony. Here, the qualification is he must have a good reputation. Well, with whom? With those outside the church. There is something blameworthy about a man's character if the consensus of those outside the church is unfavorable. But you might be thinking, well, what does a non-believer know? How can they have any say in these leaders in the church? I mean, isn't the whole world of non-believers anti-Christian? So why would God have them have any kind of sway on a person coming into leadership in the church or not? Who cares what they think? Well, what we see here is public opinion has a place. You understand that unbelievers, because they are without mercy, they scrutinize the actions of Christians. But they know you're a Christian, they likely will look at it less mercifully and be able to understand and know your actions and have judgment about those actions. Unbelievers here are actually a safeguard against inconsistent living. It's possible for us to live one way in the church when we're surrounded by brothers and sisters, and another way when we're in the workplace or the community and there are no Christians around. And so somehow, some way, the qualification of having a good reputation with non-believers has to be examined and understood before a man enters into position of elder. Colossians 4 and verse 5, the Apostle Paul there says, conduct yourselves with wisdom toward outsiders, those who are not believers, making the most of every opportunity, talking about evangelism. And then over in 1 Thessalonians 4 and verse 12, he says, behave properly toward outsiders and don't be in any need. So don't think, as important as the church is, that God has placed us here and we're to ignore the world and not ever really think about them. There's an evangelistic thinking about them, yes. But there's also, by God's common grace, he's given people the ability to think logically often. And if somebody has a bad reputation with non-believers, something is going wrong there. Now, as you examine this, it could be they have a bad reputation with those outside the church because they're so Christian and they're continually talking about Christ and they love the Lord so much and they're eager about winning people to a relationship with the Lord and people are turned off by that. Well, that's one thing. Paul's talking about something else here. He's talking about they just don't have a good testimony because of how they act. Maybe there's duplicity involved. Maybe they're too overbearing. Maybe they're too forceful. Well, what's the reason? Look at the end of verse 7. Again, so that. Very clear. Here's the reason. So that he will not fall into reproach and the snare of the devil. So he won't fall into reproach. Full circle here, right? What was the very first qualification? Above reproach. We go through all 15, we get to the end, and the purpose of this last one is that so he won't fall into reproach. The idea here is if you are living a life that is not constant in the church and in the community, reproach will eventually cling to you. There will eventually be a problem. People will come and try to tie together this person being not just a Christian, but a leader in the church. And his life is like this. It's stained by that, by these words, by those actions. And it will bring him down. And this is not talking about at the end of verse 7 where it says the snare of the devil. Not talking just about leadership in the church. The snare of the devil, the trap that he sets, like a hunter laying out traps to capture something, that is talking about the man's spiritual life. That if you try to live duplicitously for any length of time, eventually it will affect negatively your faith. And you'll be brought down. The devil enjoys that, bringing you down. He enjoys it even more if you're a leader in the church and he can bring you down because of the people it will impact. So in these last three qualifications, we have a qualification in relation to his family, and then in relation to his maturity, and finally in relation to his community. The qualifications of the biblical elder are laid out here for us. And God is working through Paul to Timothy, to us, to emphasize the importance of selection, that the church might function well. Now, what's the application for the church? It is to prepare and equip leaders. What's the application for individuals? Well, it's to pursue these things. If there's an opportunity for you to serve in church leadership, or pray for these things. If there's opportunity for you to be involved in a church moving forward in selecting church leaders. In our current setting, we have unique opportunity to apply these things. There is purpose in going through the book of 1 Timothy. the purpose is that we might, as a congregation, understand these as we move into developing a plurality of leaders for this congregation, elders and deacons, and we'll get to those people next week. But the goal for you is to be saturated with the understanding of what this is about, so that you might be able to be involved in the process however God would appoint you. And this is a magnificent opportunity for us to apply, not just individually, but as a congregation, what God has said here to Timothy and indirectly to Titus as we move forward in developing into a local church body here. So I encourage you, pursue it, pray for it, and we'll see what God does as we seek to do this His way in His time. Let's pray together.